This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Circuit Court Judge Bert Ayabe formally approved a settlement in a lawsuit that many in the vacation rental industry have been eyeing. The deal was tentatively struck last week and formalized at a hearing yesterday. It now allows the State Department of Taxation to subpoena host records from Airbnb on a limited basis. A judge had previously denied the State Tax Department's subpoena because it requested years of host data, which Airbnb said was too far-reaching. The new agreement narrows the scope of the records the tax department can ask for. First, Airbnb will provide the data for the top 1,000 Hawaii earners to the tax department. It will then send an additional list of operators making more than $2,000 in revenue. For the following 2 years, the state will be able to request host data from Airbnb, but it can only request up to 500 every 2 weeks. Airbnb will also notify all of its hosts to comply with Hawaii's tax laws, including registering for a general excise tax license. Airbnb released a written statement following the agreement, saying, "We're pleased to have reached a compromise with the Hawaii State Tax Office that provides adequate data to help them enforce against individuals who they suspect may have skirted tax laws while including safeguards to further host privacy. We remain committed to working with state leaders on an agreement to voluntarily collect and remit taxes on behalf of our host community and generate a projected $64 million annually to the state." The state tax office issued a news release of its own, saying, "We look forward to receiving the data. The agreement lays the groundwork for the department to enforce the tax law with similar online vacation rental platforms." It's been 3 months since the city's new vacation rules went into effect, and the Department of Planning and Permitting says since that time and since the crackdown, it has sent 178 notices of violation for ad violations and 24 for zoning. It's issued 11 notices of order that come with $1,000 fines or more, but it has not collected any money. Larry Bartley is the executive director of Save Oahu's Neighborhoods. He's not sure the state settlement will have much effect on the city and county enforcement if the state can't share its records, but he says it's a start.
We've already seen a reduction in the number of illegal advertising. We don't know if that's permanent yet or not because the county is just starting enforcement. So if the enforcement doesn't work out the way we hope it will, you know, they'll be back. If they don't think there's any threat of enforcement, those illegals will be back operating again. And then it'll just continue to grow. So I don't think the state action is going to have a big impact on the number of illegals.
You had indicated that this is just with Airbnb and that folks will just probably move to other hosting platforms.
Right. Yes, I think that's a factor. The we said before for years now that just concentrating on the state and city, just concentrating on dealing with Airbnb is kind of a mistake. I mean, it's a place to start for sure, but it's not going to be the end solution because these platforms are really nothing but a computer and a name, and they can morph and change all over the place. You strike a deal with one of them, suddenly their entire customer base could shift to another name and another location because it's all on the internet. So it's not a permit. It's not the ultimate solution to enforcement, though.
And then
regulation of the platforms themselves and trying to get enforcement through them. It's certainly a tool, and in the beginning, it's going to be an effective tool to reduce the numbers.
There's also the issue of foreign visitors, right? They may use their own platforms.
Oh, true. And there's no reason why these U.S. platforms like Airbnb can't move offshore and out of the legal reach of local jurisdictions. And they have to start somewhere. So I think, you go after the biggest thorn out there and pull it out first, and then you look for the others. And I think the state's on the right track. I have no idea how much impact this is going to have, in either the short term or the long term. Is it going to really help? Or are a lot of these people, is Airbnb going to resist it? Right now, we're trying to work with the city and get rules for neighborhood involvement. In other words, set the levels of the standards for which neighborhood testimony and evidence, non-city gathered evidence can be used and considered by the city to shut down the illegals. So we're still waiting for that. We're still waiting for the city to post a form, an evidence gathering form that is going to people on how to gather evidence, what's useful, what's not, and so so forth. I know some of the operators, and they've just got their finger up in the air waiting to see which way the wind blows to go back into operation.
That was Larry Bartley of Save Oahu's Neighborhoods. The money collected from vacation rentals is a big slice of TAT, the transit accommodation tax, nearly 30%, with the rest coming from hotels and timeshares. And 45% of the state's vacation rentals are here on Oahu. Seth Colby is a tax researcher and planning officer at the State Tax Department. He talked with producer Jason Ubai about the effect of Honolulu's Bill 89, which significantly restricts the number of vacation rentals in Honolulu.
The revenue that's coming from transient accommodation rentals has been increasing substantially. That is due to two reasons. One is we're actually increasing rates, but even if you adjust for those rates, the revenues have been increasing, while at the same time, we haven't really added that many more rooms to in terms of our hotel capacity. And the rate increase or the revenue increase coming from that outstrips the rate in room rates. So, yes, it is becoming a larger and larger portion.
And now you said the ordinance passed in – well, I know the city passed the ordinance in August, so – Have the numbers for August come in on your side at the State Department of Tax?
Yes. So it didn't pass. It went to effect August 1st.
Okay.
The numbers have come in, and the numbers did not have an impact. Again, we aren't really expecting to see an impact, and if there will be one, until next year, 2020. And the reason for that is, most of the accommodations get booked 3 months ahead of time,
Okay. Right?
So during this year, it's very difficult to see things in the data.
Can you tell me how much is currently collected from the transient accommodation tax and then how much is that compared to, I mean, the entire tax collection general fund?
Yes. So we collect about... In our last fiscal year, we collected $600 million from the transient accommodation tax. And then since people have to pay the GET on top of the TAT, you can add another $234 million. So last year, from transient accommodations, we collected $834 million. Our total tax collection revenues represented close to $8 billion, so we're talking about 10% of fiscal revenues.
Okay. If we were able to collect the tax money, I mean, what do you see as the possible collections for the state?
So, one, we are already collecting tax. We are already collecting taxes from these people. The question is, who's not paying taxes, right?
Yeah.
However, that's not really what Ordinance 89 is about and not what we were modeling. We were modeling is what happens if you actually take these transient accommodations off the market and tourists stop spending in Oahu and stop coming to Hawaii. And the economic impacts could be quite large. If we don't expect this, but if 100% of the TVUs in the city and county of Honolulu went away, that would have billions of dollars of economic impact.
Okay.
And the other thing I would like add to that is there's just a number of variables that we just don't know right now, right? So not only do we not know how well the city and county of Honolulu is going to enforce or how strictly they're going to enforce this and what will the effect on listings, we don't know what the tourists are going to do. Are the tourists not going to come? Are they going to stay in hotels? Or are they going to go to outer islands that are not having such strict or our neighbor islands that are not having such strict enforcement laws? So there's lots of moving parts here. And one of the things to think about when people are traveling is they usually have a budget, right? So a lot of people when they do a vacation like I do when I travel is I know how much money I want to spend on this vacation, right? So it is possible that they'll spend the same amount of money. They'll just shorten the time on the island.
Is there anything else on TVUs that you want to talk about?
I would also say that, you know, while we are giving out these numbers, these aren't the only fiscal numbers that they would impact. This also impacts income, right? Because a lot of people are making, you know, deriving a significant part of income from these TVUs, and that is also collected in income tax, right? And that money is re-spent within the economy. So even though we're talking about, you know, $800 million of direct tax revenue, the indirect tax revenues are probably significant as well. You know, not only that, if you're, you know, somebody who is renting out a room in your home and you are making an additional, let's say, $5,000 a year, the propensity is to spend that money, right? So that money is also, once again, recirculated within the economy by going out to dinner, buying surfboards, whatever. And so it does have a cyclical effect. It does build on one another as well.
That was Seth Colby, tax researcher and planning officer at the state tax office. He tracks how vacation rentals affect state tax revenues.
Most of us think the human mind is unique. But Lori Santos has spent enough time around monkeys to know that we're wrong.
It's kind of sad to admit that you're getting ripped off by monkeys, but it happens more than you'd think.
Using monkeys and their antics to understand the human mind, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 7, following Says You.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we examine Hawaii's long history with coffee production. The first recorded cultivation of coffee plants in the islands came from Don Francisco de Paula, also known as Manini, who indicated in his journals that he first planted coffee seedlings in 1813 on Oahu. Later in 1825, a gardener by the name of John Wilkinson came to Hawaii on the HMS Blonde, bringing coffee plants from Brazil. The royal governor at the time, Boki, provided land to cultivate the crop, but Wilkinson died before the plan could come to fruition. It wasn't until the Great Mahele of 1848 that significant swaths of land would be set aside for the sole purpose of coffee production. When the 1873 Vienna World's Fair came around, a coffee farmer by the name of Henry Nicholas Greenwell was awarded a ribbon of excellence, giving credence to the Kona variety of coffee and establishing its worldwide popularity. For nearly 100 years, coffee production in Hawaii would occasionally rise and fall, seeing rapid growth and then deep economic depression. Following the closing of sugar plantations in the 1990s, however, Hawaii coffee production enjoyed a slow but steady resurgence that many farms still enjoy today. But did you know that Hawaii isn't the only state that grows coffee commercially? For today's backyard quiz, tell us where else in the U.S. that coffee's grown. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the real estate agents and staff of Locations, proudly supporting HPR's commitment to sharing local stories of Hawaii's people and places. Locations, welcome home.
There's a certain synergy that you get when you combine the best of the best, and that's just what the Honolulu Jazz All-Stars brings on Saturday, November 9th in HPR's Atherton Studios. West Coast-based guitarist Doug McDonald, who got his start in Hawaii, leads the group with jazz standards as well as some fresh and swingin' originals. Get your tickets now at hbrtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
It is now time for our reality check. Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Nick Gruby was there at the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. for a hearing on the Maui case involving the Clean Water Act. Good morning, Nick.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so tell us, what was the line of questioning that came down in this case?
Well, so this is a case that involves a wastewater treatment plant in Lahaina that dumps millions of pumps millions of gallons of treated sewage into the ground, and then that sewage gets into the groundwater and makes its way to the ocean, where it affects the coral reefs, leads to increased algae growth that suffocates the coral and harms the reef and kills the reef there. Now, there's no denying on any side that this is what is happening with the treated wastewater that's going into the ocean. But Maui County aligned itself with the Trump administration to make the argument that, hey, we're putting the pollutants into the ground. We're not putting it directly into the ocean. The fact that it went there via groundwater, that shouldn't be our problem. We shouldn't be forced to comply with the Clean Water Act as a result. Now, the justices didn't really seem to buy that argument during the oral arguments. Both the liberal and conservative wings presented some pretty tough questioning to the lawyers from that represented Maui County and the Trump administration on that very fact. Justice Breyer, in particular, said, so what you're saying is if we believe your interpretation, we would be providing a roadmap for polluters to sort of evade the Clean Water Act. All they would have to do is, instead of putting a pipe directly into the water and being required to have a permit to discharge pollutants, could cut that pipe 5 feet short, bury it in the ground, put it in the groundwater, and have no regulation at all. And so that was one of the main thrusts of the argument that was ongoing, and the justices really didn't seem to buy it from Maui County or the Trump administration's attorneys.
Anything else that was surprising to you?
It was an interesting dynamic in the courtroom. There were a lot of funny moments that occurred when the justices were questioning the attorneys representing all sides. For instance, a lawyer for the Trump administration, a deputy solicitor general, had tried to make the argument that if he spiked punch with whiskey using a flask, people wouldn't think that prior to that, that the whiskey came from a bottle sitting at his house, that they would say that it came from a bottle or that it came directly from his flask, as a way to sort of support his argument that, hey, there's an in-between here that sort of cuts the chain of delivery. David Henkin, who represented Earth Justice later, when he had his opportunity to sort of respond to that argument during the questioning, said, it doesn't matter how the whiskey got in the punch, you spiked the punch, and the whiskey clearly came from that bottle, so you should be held accountable. So I think that those were some of the more interesting moments that occurred inside the courtroom.
Interesting. So what did the county have to say following the line of questioning?
Well, I did have an opportunity to speak with Mayor Victorino, albeit briefly. He really didn't want to talk after the proceedings. I had to sort of follow him out of the court, out of the courtroom as he went out a side door, leaving the courthouse, and sort of went towards the back of the courtroom, not toward the front where other members of the bar who had litigated and spoke to the in front of the Supreme Court went, such as David Henkin. And the whole time I was trying to ask him, why are you pursuing this case? Let's stop and talk and give me your perspective. And he didn't really want to answer too many questions about that. And in fact, a staffer who refused to identify themselves continued to body block me to try to get me away from talking to him as he continued to walk away. It was sort of a curious thing for the mayor to do, considering the high profile nature of this case.
Interesting. Do you think that he didn't feel that it went well?
You know, he did say in the few words that he did share with me that that he felt that the right questions were being asked. But generally speaking, he was pretty vague and didn't want to weigh in on the case. And as we know, the mayor has been pretty careful about the words he chooses when discussing this, because there is litigation, not only in the Supreme Court, but also now in the state court, over whether this case should have been settled. The city council voted 5-4 the county council voted 5-4 to settle this case before it went to the Supreme Court and had the potential to set precedent that carved a loophole into the Clean Water Act. But the mayor, potentially in violation of the charter, has refused to actually settle the case. And now, of course, that will be playing out over the next several weeks and possibly months.
Okay. Well, we'll see. We'll see what comes out on the wash. But thanks so much, Nick.
All right. Thanks.
That was reporter Nick Gruby with today's reality check. To read his full story, go to civilbeat.org. Well, today on The Long View, our contributing analyst, Neil Milner, is here to talk about improving the relationships between police and the communities they serve, right? I mean, we need to improve our relationship with our police department.
Well, yes. This that I'm going to talk about comes from a little bit different setting and with a different set of problems, at least on the surface. And it has to do with what the Department of Justice offered during the Obama administration, because of all of the police-involved shootings, the Ferguson, Eric Garner in New York, and the chokehold thing, they offered $6 million that would go to six different cities to test some ways of rebuilding or maybe building trust between the police and the community, saying essentially, this has to be done. And they got a couple of experts and a couple of institutions that are expert to develop a process by doing this. And these institutions specialize in trust building. Now, before we go anywhere else, I want to make it very clear that when they took it out to six cities around the country, not the biggest cities, but pretty good-sized cities, including Stockton, California, which we'll talk about in detail, this was not a kind of woo-woo kumbaya moment, that these things are developed in certain sorts of ways. They include other things besides trust building. But the assumption was, the working assumption was, we have the tools and the skills to get at this fundamental issue of distrust between communities, particularly minority communities and police. So they did. $6 million went out. They had experts helping the police to do it. And it was up to these experts, but mainly up to the police in the cities to figure out how to make it work.
Yeah, and it's about, well, changing behavior, too.
Yeah, oh, yeah, it's about changing behavior. So the first thing that these things involved, and we'll talk about Stockton, because of all of the cities, Stockton, which is a city of about 300,000 people in California, Stockton had the most successful outcome. The crime rate went down, the homicide clearance went down. There was a higher degree of sense of trust and a sense of safety with the police in the town. But what they did in this town was very interesting, and it was very much built around this kind of curriculum. The first thing that you did was to have these listening sessions all over the city. Now, we are a little bit cynical toward listening sessions here because the mayor's office uses them all the time, and people call them non-listening sessions. This chief took it very seriously, listened to a lot of stories from people with experience, you know, bad experiences with the police. And he did one crucial thing. He's an up-from-the-ranks cop. He said, I felt that in order to build trust, you have to apologize for police actions, not just the actions of a particular case, but you had to make public apologies frequently that said, look, I didn't do it in the sense that I'm not responsible myself, or my department is not responsible itself right now for what happened over the past 50 years or 100 years. But I know that it's essential for us to apologize for our role in essentially a kind of racism.
Yeah, it's an acknowledgement.
The acknowledgement. Now, remember, this is a police department that's doing this, and it had some very important effects. It was very hard for the chief. At first, people didn't listen to them, but it appears to me, if you read the studies, that this was the catalyst that allowed the community to move forward. He did other things. They changed training. They emphasized some stuff on implicit bias. They gave police a lesson on kind of racial equality. But it was all this kind of mix that was based on the notion that you have to rebuild trust in very systematic ways.
So the other cities that they looked at was not then the same success that saw.
No, mixed. There were mixed success. The other cities were, if I can remember, Pittsburgh, Gary, Fort Worth, and one or two others. What happened in those cities is that, in Birmingham, Alabama, in each of those cities, something worked all right. Some of these same kinds of things worked all right, but they all didn't work as well as Stockton, and you can't see a pattern of why it worked and why it didn't. The reason has as much to do, I'll get back to some of the things that they say that makes this harder. The reason you can't tell is because, unlike Stockton, this one in-depth look at Stockton, is that the assessment was a comparative assessment. You couldn't get into the weeds. You didn't know as much about what happened in say, Birmingham or Gary as you now knew about Stockton. And of course, the Urban Institute that did the study, a very reputable study, would do that. But I think there's another important lesson here, not just about police reform, but about any other kind of reform. And it's this. Stockton was exceptional in the situation it was in. First of all, it was in such bad shape that people were willing to try something. It had a 29-year-old mayor that said, go for it. It had a police union. Remember how crucial the Grand Confine. It had a police union that had really cordial relationships with the chief. So, and you had a chief who was about as reform-minded as you're going to find. So that mix all worked together, and there seems to be a commitment to continue to carry this forward.
So the stars were lining
up. The stars were lining up, and in other places, what seemed to happen is that the stars didn't seem to line up quite that way. There wasn't as much commitment. But here's the kicker here about commitment. These kinds of social reforms work to the extent that there is sustained commitment to them. I mean, so let's say Stockton did okay up to now. It still was a short-term thing. If you liked what you saw in Stockton, then you should remain committed to it, put the resources in. The Trump administration's Department of Justice, Jeff Sessions is a real hard-line, old-fashioned cop guy. They eliminated that money. So that all the money that you would get from the feds or from a grant that came partially with the feds from private sector, that's gone. So this sustained commitment, if you had to rely on that, is gone. And these are two typical kinds of things that we see that are troubling and problematic in all kinds of forms. You see it in education all the time. Certain things work, but you're not sure why. When you find out why, they have a lot to do with what is down in the weeds. Or even if they do work, politicians lose their interest in it, which means you lose your money and then they disappear.
But I imagine, too, that if you're trying to track something, you would need good data.
Exactly. And there wasn't in some of these cities. There wasn't. Criminal justice data is a little bit sloppy. So especially if you're trying to look across the board, you need comparative data that all makes sense. And they said, the Urban Institute said that was a problem with some of the cities. Some of the cities didn't have data. They may have had different criteria for it. To me, that's a minor problem compared to these other challenges about commitment and sustainability. And those two.
So is there anything that we can glean from this study? I mean, we have a trust issue on some
sure.
different aspects, because I think in some of these cities, what they were looking more about race.
Sure. Well, you know, I think there are, in a general sense, there are some lessons here and perhaps some things to try. We have a different kind of racial history and a different kind of racial and ethnic composition here. I don't know if it's better or if it's worse or less complicated or more complicated. You know, you don't the 400 years of racism that you have in regard to African Americans is different here. But put that aside. I don't want to get into a situation of whether we're better off or worse off. But it seems to me that some of these ideas about trust and reconciliation and some of these ideas about training are promising in other kind of settings, too. You don't necessarily talk about the same things or the same languages, but it strikes me that in a community like this, where there have been some issues about police-involved shootings and people suing them, and the police department right now being in a kind of because of the scandal that was involved. It seems to me that some of these ideas could be tested, could be tried here, and there's plenty of expertise along these lines. But it's hard to bring about police reform. Police tend to be a fairly closed institution. The fact that Stockton was so successful and how it was successful reminds you what you really need to make that work.
Okay, but it begins with an apology.
It begins, well, I think it begins, you have to figure out, you have to be willing to take responsibility. You have to be willing to listen a lot in a sincere sort of way and share your own stories with it. And it probably would involve some kind of apology, certainly not stonewalling.
Right, but it's a start. Well, that's the long view. Neil Milner, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Neil Milner is a retired professor of political science and contributing editor of our segment, The Long View.
Coming Saturday, November 16th, classical pianist Naomi Niskala brings a solo performance to HPR's Atherton Studios, playing works by Arnold Schoenberg, Roger Sessions, and Vivian Fine on HPR's Burzendorfer Concert Grand Piano. Presented in partnership with Ebb and Flow Arts, get your tickets now at hprtickets.org. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
A day after a big sweep in Kaka'ako, we talk homelessness and the efforts by homeless youth. HPR's Noe Tanigawa is here to talk about the latest. Good morning.
Hey, hi, Catherine. We've been following the lives of Kapo'eo Kaka'ako, that hui of people living there on Ilalo Street on the Mauka side of Ala Moana Boulevard there near Kaka'ako Park. And actually, they don't call them sweeps anymore, but that enforcement happened Tuesday, and that area is pretty much cleaned out right now. I mean, at one time, there were about 100 people living in and around the park, but through the summer and fall with the enforcements and so on, as HPD Sergeant Kadori called them, he says, well, they pretty much, the city has pretty much taken back the area now. They cleared the sidewalks. 8 core members of Kapo'e moved into shelter at Hale Maoliola there on Nimitz, and about 30 others have moved elsewhere, not sure where. Kapo'e leaders are worrying now about how to keep the community together because they're still in talks with the lieutenant governor about a parcel of land in Mapunapuna where they can move in as a community.
Oh, interesting.
Still happening. And I'd like to introduce you to someone now, Catherine, a young woman who used to live on the street there in Kaka'ako. I met her at the kickoff for the Oahu Youth Homelessness Demonstration Program. Okay, now her friend Nati was one of the leaders there too, and Nati's up first. She's homeless now, and she has been for years.
It first started at the age of 12 years old when I was a freshman. It started with sexual assault and family. And I was pushed away from my family. Nobody wanted to, you know, hear my voice. Nobody didn't believe because they didn't believe it would happen in families. So here I am today, standing up for those who's been through what I've been through or who's been through worse. And we just want our voices to be heard, and we just want to change.
Could happen, because the good news is Partners in Care, Oahu's kind of homeless services coordinator, has just gotten a $3.8 million grant for youth homeless services. What's the need? Laura Thielen, executive director of Partners in Care Oahu, told me youth service providers like Youth Outreach, RISE, Halekipa, IHS, Family Promise, all those other programs know that there's a big gap in care between 18 and 24. Almost no services for unaccompanied minors between 14 and 17, critical years. And that youth are aging out of the foster programs with very little support when their lives really need it. A 2018 study found about 300 homeless youth statewide, and about half of them are living on their own. Over 58% had attempted suicide.
Those are startling numbers.
You just wonder what they have to go through. Carla Hauser, director of RISE, got the Oahu Youth Advisory Board together a few years ago. These are unsheltered kids, asking them, what would actually make your lives better? So they've been meeting for several years now, strategizing on what would help their own constituencies. And they made a pitch for funds through Housing and Urban Development. And they got this $3.8 million grant to develop programs. Okay, now, you and I have kids. We know what they're like at every tender age. So let's hear from Nati and also from Pualani, another Oahu Youth Advisory Board member. She was homeless from elementary school, started couch surfing in high school. I mean, let's find out what kind of problems kids face when they're living on the street.
What we dealt with was trying to keep our hygiene up, trying to go to school with clean uniforms, trying to not be bullied, and transportations. Like, we would ride our bikes to school, or we would get dropped off from our uncle Like Like, or we would, you know, figure out something. If not, we would miss it. And also, we dealt with trying to find electric, trying to find power, trying to find light for us to do our homeworks, you know, and
especially because we had a lot of storms and we were homeless, so all of our stuff would get soaked and wet the day before we had to turn in our homework. And sometimes we just lack the confidence to even show up because of just how we felt. No one wants to wake up in the morning and feel sick or just feel like they're unwanted in the community and go to school and actually have to put a smile on in front of the teacher. You know, it's hard to like uplift yourself. It's not just about the academics, it's about our spirit. That's what it's about.
Can you imagine, really? I mean, that was Pualani. She's been homeless since elementary. She was at a family shelter in Kaka'ako until January this year, but she's rotating between family and friends now and has a job at Jamba Juice Ward. So she's pulling things together here. But I had to ask her, you know, what really is it like for elementary school kids in those super tender years?
For the kids?
Yeah.
You know, for them being kids, they don't even know the difference. They're just living their life, and I know that the people around them are encouraging them to don't even focus on what's happening in the community, just stay in school. Because for the kids that are on the streets and that we grew up with, all we did was encourage them to go to school, do their homework, and don't even mind about what's going on over here because your job is to be a kid.
I mean, but is there anything we can do to make this easier, really? So I asked Nati and Poo, okay, like what? What could you possibly use? It was kind of interesting, Catherine, because like Nati said, well, how about maybe some washing machines at school that we could use? You know, that would help them so much because they had to hand wash everything. They never knew when it would dry. And she said maybe the gyms at schools, could they be open extra hours or maybe after school so kids could take a shower? She said those things would be used. She said maybe there could be an extra clothing bank. And both of them really, I think, kind of went back to asking teachers to really observe how kids are responding and what their parents are like. They said it all goes back to the parents. If you see parents showing up late to pick them up, teachers, I mean, they got a lot on their plate, right?
You know, I know the Waikiki Health Center, they handle a lot of young people there, and they have a wish list, you know? They need, athletic socks, shoes.
Wow.
Backpacks.
Let's check that wish
list.
Amazing. That's a terrific idea.
Things to help the kids right away.
And, you know, it was great to be at this PIC, Partners in Care stakeholder meeting, and see who's got some kuleana here, because there was a principal from Kaimuki High School was there, someone from Corrections was there, DOE. I mean, and the youth was there. They're there to guide and vet these programs, and it's not a one-shot. Successful programs will continue to get HUD funding.
It's interesting because the times I've been out in a lot of these encampments and you talk to the young people and they say, oh, I've been out here with my family for years. It just kind of breaks your heart.
It does. It does. Maybe there are ways that they can show us, that the youth themselves on this board can show us what will really help their lives.
But that's great. I mean, you know, they're at the table.
There they are. Okay, let's see what happens now.
Yeah, so is there a summit for this thing?
Well, yesterday was the kickoff, and they got all these incredible stakeholders from across the community together, and they're just going to continue to try to hone things down and actually develop several programs. They will invest in, pilot projects, and then once they're off on their way again, HUD is offering continued funding to successful programs.
Well, I know Carla's a spark plug
over
at RISE. It's amazing.
So happy
Lots
to
of
meet
energy.
Her. Let's stay in touch with these guys.
All right. Thanks so much, Noe. We've been talking with Noe Tanigawa about homelessness and our youth. You can find her story online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Mid-Pacific Institute, a community of innovators, artists, and individuals with a one-to-one technology program designed to foster creativity and problem-solving for tomorrow's world. midpac.edu.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we looked at the storied history of coffee production here in Hawaii. The first known crop was unsuccessfully cultivated in 1813, and various efforts to plant coffee commercially would go on in vain for decades. Massive land redistribution by King Kamehameha III allowed for large portions of land to be dedicated solely to commercial coffee growth. And in 1880, the first coffee mill would be built near Kealakekua Bay on the Big Island. When Hawaii was annexed in 1898, the value of sugar skyrocketed and many coffee trees were torn up to make way for the new cash crop. In the following years, small-scale coffee production would be kept alive in part due to the efforts of Japanese laborers who would start small coffee farms after their sugar labor contracts expired. Today, Hawaii is world famous for its coffee production, particularly on the islands of Hawaii and Kauai. You may have heard of the Grain Belt or the Bible Belt, but Hawaii has the Coffee Belt. It might come as a surprise to know that Hawaii isn't the only state that grows coffee commercially. It shares that distinction with its Pacific neighbor, California. Congratulations to Walter Rodby in Honolulu. You got it right. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Loretta Oblisayer is a local performer with an incredible history, from getting her big break during a 1 a.m. show with comedian Andy Bumatai to playing concerts on the same bill with superstars like James Brown to playing a major role in South Pacific on Broadway and in London's West End. She's got stories to tell. Ahead of a Sunday 7 p.m. show at the Blue Note, Loretta took time to talk to HPR's Dave Lawrence.
Thank you for being available.
Thank you, Dave. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you here. And sometimes you'll talk to artists and could be their parents played music, could be they watched a certain thing on television, could be a teacher at school. A lot of different things spark something in someone. And when I was looking at you, from a very young age, knew you wanted to be a singer and a performer. And in part, in terms of who you would credit that, it would be maybe to your mom's record collection factoring in?
Yes, absolutely. When we were growing up, there were five of us kids. My stepfather was in the Navy. We really didn't have money, but my mom loved music, and she used to play records all the time. Sarah Vaughan, Ella Fitzgerald, The Beatles, Mario Lanza. There was a lot of different kind of music that we listened to, and music became the catharsis in my life.
When was the first time you started singing yourself?
Maybe 3 years old.
Wow.
Any opportunity that I could get up and sing. And then eventually, when I went to elementary school in kindergarten class, when everybody would bring show and tell things, I would bring Sarah Vaughan and stand in front of the class and sing Sarah Vaughan.
When did it start that you were performing professionally?
I performed all through high school. And then right after high school, I started doing sales for Kaolin Kapona Beamer when they were at the Ocean Showroom, and Andy Bumatai was their opening act. At that time in Waikiki, they had two shows on Fridays and Saturdays at 9 and 11. And then Andy did a solo show at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
That all the entertainers in town used to come to after their shows.
Unbelievable.
Those back in the day, right? Yeah. I mean, like nowadays, Blue Note has a show at 6:30 and 9 o'clock.
Right. Everyone's asleep by 1.
So I was doing this show, seating people at 1 o'clock, and Andy says, you know, we keep hearing that our host is over here can sing, or we're going to ask her to come up and sing. And I did, and it just so happened Kaola and Capone were sitting in the house that night after their shows, and Kaola called me the next day and asked me to be the featured female vocalist in their next show.
That was your debut there?
Yeah.
At a 1 a.m. Andy Bumatai
yes.
show. And this is 1979?
Yes.
Incredible.
Had any small detail changed? Had Kaola and Capone not stayed? Had I gone home after I'd seated the people? Any of that? Then none of that would have happened in that way.
Well, it's like sometimes it seems like it's meant to be.
Right.
I have James Brown down as the biggest act I know of that you have opened for. Would right. you second that?
I would second that.
Where? What venue?
This was the Sheraton Waikiki.
Wow, he played in that place.
Yes.
2001, is that right?
I believe so, yeah.
You ever seen him in concert?
Never. So I was there for sound check and I didn't leave, which was amazing to watch, too, because he was really tough on the band.
Did you get to interact at all with him?
No. I think I said hello to him.
Did he play organ and stuff?
No.
Just directed
the
band?
No, he had the most incredible band.
Oh, I'm sure.
Night.
He'd catch anybody not doing something. As he's turning, he'd be like, that's $5.
Oh, God. He stopped during sound check. I mean, he was playing, and it was just intimidating.
So you watched him do a little
Absolutely.
Of that?
Absolutely. I was taking in every second I could.
Was he angry, or was it just a quick thing? Or
no. He was angry, and he used every word that you can think of as he was explaining to them, and he would chastise them and have them do it over and over and over. It was scary to watch. On the other hand, when you're watching a master...
Did it end on a good note at soundcheck, or, I mean, did they just leave?
Yes.
He was happy when they were done.
Yes.
You've done a lot of different stuff. I mean, that is a good... Because you're also... I know you've done some stage stuff.
Right.
South Pacific.
Right.
They found you here and then brought you to New York City to work at Lincoln Center.
It's a crazy story, but I'll condense it for you. Diamond Head Theater is my home theater. I've only been able to do a couple of productions with him because as a chick singer, I was working, you know, 5 nights a week, 6 nights a week. That's my income.
Right.
So when you do community theater in Hawaii, you don't get paid.
Right.
So just a couple of times when you're in between gigs, a show would open up there and I'd be able to do it. And I do the fundraiser, the Alima Awards, with him every year, and met a former Broadway actor that was living in Hawaii. And he said to me during rehearsals for the show, you should be doing Broadway. And we just kind of laughed it off. He left and went back to New York. And this is a couple of years later. I get a phone call. They have decided to audition for South Pacific. They're trying to cast it. The first time that it was ever back on Broadway since it debuted in 1949. They had cast a couple of roles, but they couldn't find anyone to portray the role of Bloody Mary. Plus, their families, Rodgers and Hammerstein's families, were very involved in this. And they wanted everyone to be cast appropriately and the show to be done the way that their fathers and James Michener had created the show to be. And it just so happened my friend was having lunch with his friend, who was the musical director of the show, who was telling my friend Randall Ask that they couldn't find anyone. And Randall said, have you guys ever thought of auditioning anybody in Hawaii? Just so happened the casting agent had an agent that was going to be coming to Hawaii a week later. 45 minutes before I was supposed to be there, I walked into my husband's office and told him I wasn't going to go because I didn't think I could do it. And he said, I don't want you to regret this. You need to take a chance on this, and I'll drive you down there, and you can work on these songs. And he did. I went into the audition, and I just did what I was supposed to do the best that I could. The agent said to me as I left the room, it's going to take about 6 weeks for everybody that needs to see this audition tape to see it. 2 days later, my phone rang, and it was the casting agent, and he had shown this audition tape to the director, who said, that's her. And they flew me to New York, and I had 2 auditions, one for the director, musical director, and musical theater director at Lincoln Center. And then I had a bigger audition a couple of days later, probably about 18 people in there. Unbeknownst to me, it was the entire Rodgers and Hammerstein organization and everyone from Lincoln Center that was involved in all of this, and they all had to say so. And they called me back in the room and hired me. And they flew me to New York the following January, and I was there for 3 years.
3 years.
Crazy. And then came back home for about 6 months, and they took me to the West End in London, and we did it at the Barbican. And then I did the tour across the UK, the same production. Yes, it was an incredible opportunity to meet some of my greatest heroes in the music business. You know, the greatest one for me, I got this knock on my dressing room door. Our stage manager says, James Taylor wants to meet you. And to walk down the hall and he's standing there. James Taylor has helped me cry through so many heartbreaks and joys through my life. So all of a sudden now, here's this time that this man that I idolized came to see the show that I was in. And then another knock on my door, dressing room door, and it's Bette Midler is here, and she'd like to meet you.
And there you have the Hawaii connection.
Yes, and high school connection. We both went to Radford.
Wow.
Yeah, and to have her sitting in my dressing room for a half an hour as we're talking all about Hawaii and all about performing and all about Radford and growing up in Hawaii, it's wild. This is my life.
It's Loretta Ablasayer, an easy person to talk to at the Blue Note Sunday at 7. Lots of things that you can draw from. A life filled with experiences. I'm really appreciative that you came down to do this. I hope it was fun going through some of this with me. Maybe sometime we'll have you sing in the Atherton or something like that.
I would love that. I actually recorded my CD here.
What haven't you done? Thanks for coming down. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dave. Thanks.
I've got your number. I know you inside out. You ain't no Eagle Scout. You're all at sea.
And that was HPR's Dave Lawrence with actress and singer Loretta Ablasayer. In 2008, she debuted on Broadway as Bloody Mary in South Pacific. Her performance garnered a Tony nomination for Best Featured Actress in a Musical, and she won the 2008 Theater World Award. She will be at the Blue Note, Hawaii, this Sunday. And we've run out of time. Up tomorrow, will you take the coral pledge? We talk about the latest effort by the state to protect our coral reefs. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talk back line. Leave your comments. Call 808-792-8217. Hey, and if you missed any of the show or want to find a past one, find them all on the conversation page. Look under HPR News and Talk for the conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of the conversation.